This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Allison Stewart in Washington, D.C. Neal Conan is away. Alongside her presidential husband, Michelle Obama will walk the corridors of the White House starting in late January. She will turn 45 years old just 3 days before she officially becomes First Lady. She's an Ivy League educated lawyer, mother of two young girls, in charge of perhaps the most important transition of her family's life. Some women can relate to Mrs. Obama's balancing of a high-powered job with a high-powered family and ultimately having to take a step back behind a high-powered husband. Others see her as an enigmatic figure simply challenging the standards of race and class. Today, we talk about what you see in Michelle Obama. A little bit later in the hour, retribution after the Prop 8 vote in California. Where do you draw the line? But first, how do you see Michelle Obama? What are your expectations of her as First Lady? Our number here in Washington is 1-800-989-8255, and the email address is talk@npr.org. You can always join the conversation over at the website. Go to npr.org and click on Talk of the Nation. We're going to begin today with NPR's Michelle Martin. She is host of NPR's Tell Me More, and she joins us in Studio 3A. Thanks for joining us today.
Happy to take the trip downstairs.
What do you see when you see Michelle Obama?
Well, Allison, to be honest with you, I think we are all looking at ourselves. I think we all are. Mm. I just think that is it's human, but it is also something that we tend to do with women more than with men. And I remember a conversation I had with Nobel laureate Wangari Maathai. She was the first African woman to earn a PhD mm-hmm. in her field, founder of the Green Belt Movement, Nobel laureate, as I said. And before she became internationally known, she was married to a Kenyan legislator. One of the things she pointed out to me was that how even though men who were expressing themselves and trying to present themselves as modern, the new face of Kenya, they still expected their wives to wear traditional dress. To entertain in the traditional way. And she said it became very difficult for her, but it just became a thing where it just, wives carry the culture, women carry the culture. So I think it's a difficult tightrope that Michelle Obama is walking. I think it's harder than perhaps we have given her credit for. Mm-hmm. I think she has my tremendous sympathy.
Sympathy?
Yes.
Why do you feel she needs sympathy?
She doesn't need it. It's a gift. but I think it's a very difficult job. I think the job of First Lady is very difficult, regardless, because, as I said, there is no title of First Lady. It's not an official title. It's something that we have created. And I think that they just are symbols, no matter what they do. Mm-hmm. All public figures are symbols. You're a symbol, too. I mean, to the degree that people are aware of who you are, they are. But the fact that she carries all of our contradictory images of women. Mm. You remember that when Barbara Bush was invited to speak, First Lady Barbara Bush, the wife of Bush 41, George H.W. Bush, was invited to speak at Wellesley, which she had attended. I can't remember if it was Wellesley or Smith, but... forgive me that I don't recall, but I remember that the seniors asked Smith, I think the seniors there said that they really weren't sure that that's who they wanted to hear from, that they thought that her life really wasn't going to bear any resemblance mm-hmm. to theirs, and that they were heavily criticized for this. It was like, how dare you? But and she did eventually speak there, and she gave a wonderful speech about balance and work-life balance. But the reality was that her life did not resemble theirs at that time in any meaningful way. But they were raising an interesting question, which is, what does your life have to do with mine? And Michelle Obama, of course, all of this is surrounded by the echo chamber of race and all mm-hmm. the complicated feelings that people have about race. I think so often when we look at Michelle Obama, we're really looking at ourselves, and we're looking at her to resolve all the contradictions we have not yet resolved for ourselves, and that includes what we expect of women and what we think of African Americans and educated women and all of that.
Well, let's break it down to just something very personal. When you're an African-American woman, just for anybody who didn't know that and isn't familiar, when you interview anybody in any sort of journalistic endeavor, when you're interviewing somebody about divorce and then you have been in a family that's divorced, you have a certain insight. You just do. As an African-American woman, when you see Michelle Obama, what is the insight you think you might have that someone else, that an Asian woman might not have or a Hispanic guy might not have?
Well, I think it is the sense of the journey and all of the various complicating ways in which race complicates. First of all, gender. 2,000 years of social history, that's one thing. That's what happens with gender. And then with race, you've got the 400 years of the history of African mm-hmm. people of African descent in this country and all the various ways in which women, men, and all of our history has been kind of wrapped up into the majority's expectations of us and our pushing against that majority. But it's also true, I'm also a journalist. And when I look at her, I look at a very interesting subject. I mean, we've been talking about this a lot on my program.
Sure.
We just did a very interesting collaboration with TheRoot.com, the online publication, which is dedicated specifically to stories that explore the African-American zeitgeist. And we talked about this. There were four essays published earlier. And there were four essays as different as you could possibly be about what it is. And these are women who are experiencing a really relatively narrow band of life mm-hmm. experience. These are all college-educated people who all have experienced the professional life. And they had four very different takes on what they think she should do, what they think of her choices to this point.
We're going to talk to Deborah from Portland, Oregon. Deborah joins us. And Deborah, what are your thoughts about Michelle Obama and her role in the White House?
Well, I'm so excited to see a woman of such fierce intelligence and honesty attached to the White House. I know she's not in an elected position, but I think it will really affect the way that we're seen throughout the world as Michelle Obama travels with her husband. And for me, I think she's such a much stronger role model and feminist icon than the Republicans proposing Sarah Palin as a woman in public life. And so I guess I find her intelligence most compelling. And, of course, the history of having a black family in the White House is amazing. And I'm just so excited about her. And I hate that people attack her for simply being honest. When she said that thing about she hadn't felt this proud of her country in a long time, I was right behind her. And I'm a really similar age. I'm 53, but I am Caucasian. Mm-hmm. But I felt just like her. And I was cheering her on for having the honesty to say that.
Deborah, do you think she'll still be able to maintain, I think the word you used was fierceness, while she's First Lady? Do you think that people will be able to accept her as a fierce First Lady?
I think that's a real challenge, and I think it is really complicated probably by being black as well as being a woman. But I am hoping, I'm rooting for her to maintain her honesty and her fierceness, and probably she'll have to have a moderate public persona, as I myself would. If I was elected, I'd probably have to tone it down, and I realize she's not elected, but she is, you know, very much attached to the public life of Barack Obama. But I'm so excited, and I think she'll be a wonderful role model. And I'm in graduate school right now to be a school psychologist, and I'm really excited to have the Obamas to, you know, reference for kids to look at them. And I just, you know, Barack's candidacy and then her willingness to speak honestly and directly has been wonderful.
Deborah from Portland, thanks a lot. Michelle, what do you think she needs to do in her role as First Lady to maintain her role model status?
I don't think that's up to her. It's not up to her. She's going to be a role model no matter what she does, and people mm-hmm. are going to be taking cues from her and interpreting her behavior and putting their own interpretations on her decisions
but how about a role model for someone like this woman, Deborah?
Well, one of the things I found interesting is one of the people who defended her when she was being criticized for that comment was First Lady Laura Bush.
Yeah.
Laura Bush, because I think she understands what that is, even though Laura Bush has had a very traditional life in contrast to Michelle Obama's. I mean, she was a librarian with a traditionally female field, and she mm-hmm. quit work when her children were born, unlike Michelle Obama, who continued to work and be, in fact, not just an earner in her household, but in some ways out-earned her husband in some years. In some years, she was the breadwinner in that household, which I think helped them to maintain the lifestyle that they had. So that's a very different life experience. But I think that Laura Bush knows better than anybody that is a really tough job, carrying people's expectations, and a job in which you don't stand for election. And, you know.
Yes. Let's bring Rebecca Traister into this conversation. Her beat is gender and culture. She recently wrote an article for Salon.com called The Momification of Michelle Obama, and she joins us from NPR's New York Bureau. Hi, Rebecca.
Hi, Allison. Thanks for having me.
Sure, of course. You just heard our last caller, right?
Yes, I did.
What did you think about her expectations?
Well, I think that already for people like Deborah, who sort of encountered Michelle Obama during the primary campaigns and found this incredible seemingly quite brilliant powerful, professional woman with a lot of ideas, a lot of willingness to be open and frank while she was on the trail, and who then, you know, got in a lot of trouble for her frankness. I think that one of the things we've seen in recent months, and unfortunately we'll probably continue to see in coming months, is her path to becoming, as Deborah said, more moderate. Because I think we saw that this summer. There was a real change in how we began to talk about Michelle Obama, and also in how Michelle Obama had to sell herself to the American people. We could see that in her incredible speech in Denver that was moving and successful and eloquent and all those things, but in which we didn't hear anything about her Harvard Law degree or her career or her achievements, which in many ways are very comparable to her husband's, who's going to be president of the United States. We heard about her in very safe terms, in familial domestic terms, as a daughter, as a sister, as a wife, as a mother. And I think that that says a lot about our national appetite for powerful femininity, and especially for a powerful Black woman. You know, this is a country that's obviously still suffering from major anxieties about race and gender. And this was incredible history, electing the Obamas. But that there, what we saw was that maybe there are some limits to how much change America can stomach. And in electing a Black president.
Wait a minute, but you know, Cindy McCain didn't talk about the fact that she's the CEO of a major multi-million dollar enterprise, which is the beer distributorship she inherited from her father. She still is the CEO. She's still on the board. She certainly has run that company for many, many years. You never hear her talk about that.
That's true. And I would argue that, I mean, there is a selling, when it comes to selling a presidential package, a presidential family, I think that there still is an impulse to keep the woman's role, the prospective first lady's role, a comfortably traditional one. I think that's a post-Hillary hangover in part. I think that all first lady candidates at this point are going to tread far away from the two-for-one idea, and that's an idea that the Obamas could come very perilously close to because Michelle Obama has such an incredible resume.
Hey, Rebecca, I'm going to ask you to hold that thought. Sure. We're speaking with Rebecca Traister from Salon.com as well as NPR's own Michelle Martin. What does Michelle Obama mean to you? What are your expectations for her as First Lady? Give us a call here. Talk of the Nation. Welcome back to Talk of the Nation. I'm Allison Stewart. We're in the middle of a conversation with you, as well as Rebecca Traister from Salon.com. She recently wrote an article called The Momification of Michelle Obama. And we're also speaking with Michelle Martin of NPR's Tell Me More. You've covered a lot of this. You described to us earlier. You had four different women with four very different points of view about Michelle Obama. I want to go to Jean in Prairie Village, Kansas. Hi, Jean.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
Expectation for Michelle Obama is a very tall order, that she will be the force to keep Barack Obama's feet on the ground, to not believe all the PR, to not believe all the wonderful things, to keep him focused, to
help him keep it real, Jean?
Keep it real, yes. And I have confidence that she has unique gifts in that area.
All right, Jean from Prairie Village, Kansas, thanks so much. It's very interesting, Michelle, that I was looking, doing some research for this, and the title of the articles about Michelle Obama from early on in the primaries compared to the titles of the articles about Michelle Obama after that speech, the Democratic speech, she's the one who keeps him real. She keeps his feet on the ground. He's got to take out the garbage. To this sort of, there has been a media shift to change her image somewhat. Did you notice it? And when you saw it, did you notice it? Let me start. Yes, you're nodding. What was your response? What did you think?
Well, I think Rebecca wrote, I think Rebecca's piece describes that very well. But I must tell you that I think a lot of people have very complicated feelings about this, myself included. On the one hand, that's just, they're politicians. If you're in a political family, you're a politician too. And if that's what they needed to get elected, that's what they needed to do. On the other hand, I think this whole question, the momification of Michelle Obama, is a very complicated question. This is where race does play a role. The fact is that African-American women have always been more present in the labor force than white women have been. But our cultural icons don't celebrate either of those things. I mean, our cultural icons are people like Mammy and Aunt Jemima. And these are people who took care of other people's kids. So the idea that you have the choice to focus on your own children and your own household, even though people have always done this, of course, but they haven't been exactly applauded by the culture for doing so, is, I think, very exciting to a lot of people, to see a functional African-American family where the parents love each other, they are taking care of their kids, they're happy to do it, the kids are great, is something that's so relieving and exciting to a lot of people. You can't take that away from them. It would be churlish to do so. On the other hand, there is a sort of a self-effacement that comes with being in a political family. The fact that she is an attorney. For her to continue to practice in that field would be highly problematic. Just about any case or client she would take on would pose conflicts of interest, which are very, very difficult. That's where the whole Hillary Clinton thing came into being when she was put in charge of health care reform. She's an unelected official. She's not presented for Senate confirmation, and yet she's having hearings, closed hearings, with some of the most important people in the country on this issue. It's very difficult.
Rebecca, do you think that Michelle Obama will benefit in some way from Hillary Clinton being the first lady with a postgraduate degree and taking some of the shots?
Well, I think that she will both benefit and suffer from it. I mean, Hillary Clinton obviously broke a lot of barriers and, cracked a lot of our expectations for what a first lady could look like or act like. On the other hand, if you look at what happened to Hillary Clinton during her years in the White House, she started out running health care, which was a massive belly flop for a lot of complicated reasons, and sort of wound up, getting all of her international experience, visiting 82 countries and writing books, Dear Socks, Dear Buddy, Tales from the White House Pets. There was also a lot of muffling of Hillary Clinton that went on. And we forget that now because of her career after she got out of the White House as a first lady. But she didn't have an easy road to hoe. I think that Michelle Obama won't either. And as I said before, I think because there was such a culture of suspicion surrounding Hillary Clinton and her politics and her ideas and her work, that it's also, first ladies are now left with her legacy, too, which is be very careful that you don't get Hillary'd, that you don't get caught in the 2-for-1 trap with a lot of resentment directed toward you because you're partnering with your husband in some way in a job that you weren't elected to. So I think that she will both benefit and suffer from Hillary's legacy. On the other hand, I think we're also looking at major generational shifts. I mean, Hillary may have been the first lady with a postgraduate degree, but we're looking at a workforce and people who are going to be running for president far into our future where women are more and more going to have high-powered careers, extensive educations, big resumes by the time they hit the White House. Many of them may be hitting the White House as president, possibly down the road.
You know what we need to do? We need to get a fella in on this conversation. This is Carl from Washington. Hi, Carl.
Hi, how you doing?
I'm doing well.
Good. So my comment is this. Look, Michelle Obama is a national resource. She's very well educated and skilled. She absolutely should be used for her smarts and her abilities in policymaking. Of course, she represents what we all are now, have been for 2 or 3 decades. Both spouses have to work. Everyone recognizes that. And she shouldn't be confined to just a role as mother. And this is a situation that everyone's saying it. Look, it's all hands on deck. In other words, we need all of the smarts and the policy people involved to solve the problems that the country has now. So that's where I'd like to see her use her skills.
So, Carl, you're okay with Michelle Obama being chief advisor?
Not chief advisor,
in unofficial terms, shall I say?
Well, look, it's not. She's smart enough to learn from what happened to Hillary. She'll look at that and learn from it and understand what she has to do in order to be able to affect policy in those areas she's interested in, and it should be done smartly. But with all of her abilities, it would be a waste not to tap into them.
All right, Cliff from Washington. Carl from Washington. Thanks a lot. Let's go to Cliff in St. Louis. Hi, Cliff.
Hi there. Yeah, I agree with what he says, and I think that one of your commentators there made a point that she's eloquent, she's capable, she has an Ivy League background, and as a lawyer, she's a force to be reckoned with. However, we elected Barack Obama, And, you know, just as in any field of endeavor, a CEO, a CFO, whatever, of a corporation, we don't expect to see their spouse and or their children or relatives having any real horse to bear on the issues at hand. So the question is, then, how does she work within that framework? And I don't think we need to stereotype the woman. I think that she's very capable, and we will see what she does. I mean, we will see what we will see, as the French say. And she will do what she does. I'm very, very hopeful and very happy that these two people have come along at this time. And I think that most of America feels that way also. And I'm delighted that we have women who are reaching and accomplishing things. Women have always been great throughout all of history. And I think it's really sad that there are countries in which women are still considered chattel or an accessory to a man. And I'll leave it with that.
Cliff, thank you so much for calling in.
Bye-bye.
You know, it's interesting to me, a couple things that I've been sitting here thinking about is, first, that when Hillary Clinton ran for president, even though she'd been a sitting senator, people questioned whether her first lady experience was even relevant. And there was a very rich discussion about, you know, whether that actually meant that she knew anything. And the other thought that occurs, and of course, you know, a lot of people came to believe that it actually did count for something, particularly the exposure to other world leaders. But the other thought that occurs, and I'm curious what listeners think about this, you know, some universities now pay the spouse of the president a salary. Because they want to recognize the fact that they're working, too.
Sure.
They're working for the institution, and that the demands of that job make it rather difficult to hold other employment. And I'm just wondering whether Americans will ever get to the point where we'll say, you know what, that's a hard job. Maybe we should give them their own money.
Well, we see that actually, this is a little bit of a digression, but you see that sometimes in divorce cases when there's a CEO who's highly paid and the wife has been, you know, the at-home CEO who's made it possible for the CEO to go out and make all that money.
Well, because the case law is fairly clear on that. I mean, the Wendt case, the Gary Wendt case, for example, in Connecticut, where the courts were pretty clear that she had played a role and recognized that.
Rebecca, do you think that the role...
God forbid, let's not talk about divorce in the context of the Obama, shall we? Should we just move off that topic?
No, I understand.
In general? Just saying.
Rebecca, do you think that the job of First Lady is a job?
Oh, yeah. Oh, it's a job, but it's very different from the kind of job that Michelle Obama has held in the past. It is a job. It has so many responsibilities. And in fact, when I sort of have written critically about the momification of Michelle Obama, that's not to say that her stated and intended focus on motherhood isn't a huge part of that job, not to mention the kinds of responsibilities she's going to have sort of formally, publicly, internationally. But all of those things, that job is an extension of her husband's job. And I think as many many women who have been in working marriages or partnerships can tell you, it's different when you go to a job and have your own people, your own responsibilities, your own income, which, as Michelle has pointed out, was very high in Michelle Obama's case. It's a world away from your partner or your family, and it's one in which it's about you, your achievements, your thoughts, your ideas, your directives. That's not exactly going to be the case here. And that's something, by the way, that she's not, I'm not suggesting that she's being forced into this. This is a choice that they made together, clearly. But it's a different kind of job. And I think that there's something, and Michelle has written about acknowledging this, about saying when we talk about the kinds of adjustments that the Obamas are going to have to make, the kinds of adjustments that Malia and Sasha are going to have to make, that there's all, it's worth tipping a hat and saying, you know what, Michelle Obama's going to have to make adjustments here too. And it's not just about how she dresses. It's about a sense of herself, her identity, her public, professional, intellectual identity is now going to be in part attached to her husband.
I think that's the right phrase, tip a hat. Let's just acknowledge it. Let's just tip a hat. We don't have to cry for her. There are a lot of people who are really suffering out here. So let's save our sympathy and tears for people who are really in pain. And this is a choice. But let's just tip our hat and acknowledge it. Can I just say for myself, though, I'm a little aggrieved at having to share my name. You know, I was the only Michelle in town for a while. I mean, it's bad enough to share with Michelle Norris at All Things Considered. I mean, it's sort of, who's also fabulous. But I mean, she's the new sheriff in town. I think all the rest of us Michelles are just going to have to take a seat.
Oh, that's true. Every time I say Michelle has written, I just realize that as I'm talking about this, it's very confusing when you're talking about two. Yes, I was meaning you, Michelle.
Do you see what
Martin.
I'm giving up here? This really is all about me.
Let's talk to Jean in Green Valley, Arizona. Hello, Jean.
Shall I speak now?
You shall. Thank you very much for calling in.
Okay. Besides Michelle's brains and her down-to-earth balance, she has a beautiful face and beautiful hands. I would like to see some of the stylists make special clothes for her lovely tall figure. She has it all. That's all.
Well, that's a great point to make, Jean in Green Valley.
She's a wonderful mother, so what more do you ask?
Thank you so much for calling in. Karen in Colorado has an idea. Hi, Karen.
Hi. I was a member of the Colorado delegation of the Democratic Convention, and I had the privilege of hearing Michelle Obama speak 3 times. She sounded much more impressive than Nancy Pelosi or Hillary Clinton, and I can only imagine what a quick study she's going to be over the next 8 years, and I look forward to voting for her.
Thanks so much, Karen. So, could you ever see a Michelle Obama in elected life?
I could.
Yeah?
I could, once the girls are older. Once the girls are older. I could actually see both of the girls actually in public life, too, if you saw the way they rocked the mic at the convention. I think, yes, like I could see them all in some sort of role. But again, I think we don't know really how we feel about it. How much do we value that home time? I mean, being a parent, being a homemaker has been considered a noble profession on its own. You didn't need to do anything else. Your kids were the credit to the job that you did. And so, and frankly, let us give a nod to the brain space it takes to raise kids, particularly in a fishbowl like the White House, raising kids, period, in a complicated society like ours. And I just think that we don't acknowledge the brain space it takes to do that. I mean, the time that I could be sitting reading The New Yorker at night, I'm thinking about reading my child development books and looking over the school applications and things like that. And, you know, no disrespect to my husband. Is he doing that? No. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, we do have these other expectations that she'll go out in the world and be fabulous and fit and gorgeous and smart. I don't really think we know how we feel about any of this having to do with women.
I would also like to add that one of the people who's written most eloquently about this and exactly what you're describing, Michelle, is Barack Obama himself. And if anybody out there hasn't read The Audacity of Hope, he writes very beautifully about the kinds of trade-offs that have been made in his marriage after the girls came along in terms of their careers and exactly what you're talking about, whose schedule do domestic responsibilities work around? And he has written about how they've worked around his. And I think that for anybody who sort of is thinking about this and considering it, how it applies to the Obamas, Barack Obama himself is a great resource on this conversation.
You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. We're speaking with Rebecca Traister from Salon and Michelle Martin from NPR's Tell Me More about what do you expect from Michelle Obama in the White House? What do you see when you see Michelle Obama? Bryce in Iowa. Hi, Bryce.
Hi, how are you guys doing?
Good. You want to throw in a question into this conversation?
Yeah, I'm just wondering I've never heard this conversation about the white first ladies. And I think there's some unfair expectations being put on Michelle Obama, almost as if she's on academic probation, that's what it feels like. But, and I kind of hear a lot of, and I'm not saying from you folks, but in the past from a lot of radio hosts, almost like there's this sense of condescension of like, well, let's just see how these folks do, and I think like I've never heard that before. It's like all of a sudden we have, the first African-American, family in the White House. It's like, well, let's just hope they do some good things. But if they don't, then we have a reason to go back and say, see, we told you so. And I think that's extremely unfair.
Bryce, thank you so much for calling. We've got Andrew in Ohio. Hi, Andrew.
Hi there. Thank you for taking my call.
Of course.
By the way, you're doing a great job with the hosting. It's really different pace and energy. It's kind of cool.
Thanks.
My hope for Michelle Obama was that she would bring, she would restore some of the publicity and public life back to the title of First Lady. I feel like the past 8 years, Laura Bush has been under a rock. I know she's been out there, she's been doing stuff, but we never see anything about it. I feel like her First Lady-dom has been subjugated by all the vehemence over Bush and Cheney's actions, and I think it's a real shame. I think I would love to see Michelle Obama really be the public figure that maybe a Nancy Reagan was. And, it's funny, in a quick comment.
Real quick,
I never thought of this before until I was listening to this broadcast. But for all the vehement people that are really against Obama and were against women in the election, we have an African-American man who is well-spoken, clearly spoken, has a beautiful wife who is a lawyer, and has a charming, energetic kids. It's funny, I really have to wonder if these same people were against the Cosby Show, because it seems like it's kind of hypocritical that America would embrace one African-American family, but when it gets to a certain level.
Andrew, we're going to have to let you have the last word there. Thanks so much. Michelle Martin from Tell Me More, thank you for taking the time today. I appreciate it.
Thank you. Come on up and see me.
I will. Rebecca Traister from Salon, thanks for sharing your reporting with us.
Thanks so much for having me on.
I'm Allison Stewart. Stay with us. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And one more email before we wrap up the Michelle Obama discussion. We want to tip a hat, we should say, to a stay-at-home dad named Dave in Winston-Salem. He's home with two daughters. He wrote to us, "Michelle Obama especially has my utmost respect and really awe. She is so smart, so humble, so funny, and I am defying here. But I am so proud to point out to her and to suggest to my daughters that they live in a historic time, that nothing is beyond their achievement. I try not to sugarcoat the hard truths of growing up female in a male-dominated society, and my wife and I hope we instill respect for all races in our household, but simply be able to say, Michelle Obama, there she is." Dave, thank you so much for writing in to us. Now, weeks after the election, and one of the most passionate issues is still gathering heat. That would be Proposition 8, a California state ballot initiative banning same-sex marriage. The proposition passed and is heading to the California Supreme Court for review. Los Angeles Times columnist Tim Rutten has been following the reaction on both sides of the issue. He wrote a column this past weekend titled, "Both Sides in the Same-Sex Marriage Controversy Need to Cool Down." Tim Rutten joins us now from the Marketplace Studio in L.A. Welcome, Tim.
Glad to be here, Alice.
So, Tim, what brought you to write this column?
Aside from my deadline, the fact. It's an issue that I've followed with some interest as somebody who writes about Los Angeles and California politics. And it was certainly the most hotly contested of all the social issues this time around. And clearly it's still a matter of great contention. It's a matter on which Californians, like Americans as a whole, are very closely divided these days.
So why don't you think the vote was the end of it, the end of the discussion?
Well, because neither side can stand down from this without ceasing to be in some fundamental way themselves. And those are the kinds of issues in our pluralistic democracy that never go away. Abortion is an issue like that for many people. And in this case, the people who were most passionately for the proposition, remember the proposition was itself intended to overturn an earlier ruling by the California Supreme Court that gays and lesbians enjoyed the same rights under the Equal Protection Clause of our state constitution to marry as heterosexual couples. This proposition wrote into the state constitution a provision that marriage could only occur between heterosexual couples. So a yes vote meant you were against gay marriage, essentially. And the primary backers of the measure were religious groups, the Catholic Church, principally through the Knights of Columbus, the Mormon Church, and a series of evangelical megachurches mainly centered in Southern California. On the other side of the issue, you had large numbers, obviously, of gay and lesbian people, but also a lot of younger voters who see this as a civil rights issue.
Now, you obviously thought that there was a need to tell people to cool down. What kind of behaviors have been going on and what kind of activities have been going on that people need to cool down?
Well, the two things cited in the column were threats. Remember, the column was written before the California Supreme Court had even agreed mm-hmm. to hear challenges to the measure. On the one side, you had people who supported the proposition already setting themselves up, in opposition to the courts even entertaining the issue and threatening the justices, saying that if they voted to overturn the measure, and lots of state propositions here, this is the proposition capital of the known world, and lots of state propositions here are ultimately overturned by the courts. in this case, the pro Prop 8 people were already saying, if the court overturns this, we'll recall the justices. And in California, that's not an idle threat because justices come up every in staggered batches. Justices of the Supreme Court come up for reconfirmation by the voters. That's where a yes/no vote on them during every interval or so. And on the other side of the issue, you had a large number of mainly younger gay activists who, following on the heels of the outing movement within the gay community, had decided that the way to proceed from here was to comb through the computerized databases of every individual who had contributed to the Yes on 8 campaign, and to make economic reprisals against them. So there were a couple of cases already where people had lost their jobs because their employers didn't want to accept the heat from, understandably angry gay people. But that's perilously close to a blacklist in my estimation. And so the column said that intimidating the court, trying to intimidate justices in advance, is a bad idea. And that going after individuals as opposed to organizations who may have supported this proposition is an equally bad idea.
Before we go much further, I do want to make a pitch out for callers, people who are listening in. We want to hear, especially from Californians, how are you seeing this issue play out? Do you agree there needs to be some cooling down, or maybe not? Maybe you think this is the right way for activists to go. Our number here in Washington is 1-800-989-8255. The email address is talk@npr.org, and you can join the conversation at the website. Go to npr.org and click on Talk of the Nation. And Tim, what are some examples of people who have lost their jobs or have had a difficulty financially as a result of activists targeting them for their vote on Prop 8?
Well, the two examples cited in the column and two that have been widely reported on here, in one instance, the director of a very popular musical theater company in Sacramento, California, was forced to resign because he had contributed, I think, $1,000 to the Yes on 8 campaign. And here in Los Angeles, the manager of a popular Mexican restaurant in the Mid-Wilshire District, which happens to have apparently a fairly substantial gay clientele, was forced to apologize and actually has been absent from work since because she contributed $100 to the campaign. In both instances, these individuals also appear to have been or are, in fact, practicing Mormons. And, of course, the Mormon Church had urged its members to become involved in the Yes on 8 campaign.
And now I understand that some businesses actually owned by Mormons have been targeted as part of a boycott by various gay activists.
Yeah. I mean, there's one apparently one fellow who owns a number of franchised restaurants, and his franchised restaurants have been targeted. I think that there's an important distinction that probably ought to be made here.
Okay.
And that is that I think that it's one thing if an organization or a business as a business were to make a contribution to the Yes on 8 campaign, then it seems to me it's made itself a legitimate target, at least for protest. If, on the other hand, activists target individuals, the businesses that employ individuals who happen to have given, then you're basically saying to that business, you have to fire this person, or to have my trade, and that's a very different sort of business, and that's a very something perilously close to the way the Hollywood blacklist operated, something we have a very sad experience with in this community, and I think that it raises very disturbing questions about whether or not people ought to be held accountable for their exercise of free speech in the realm of politics in every other phase of their lives. Now, I understand completely the argument that this is on the part of people who support marriage equality in California. And I happen to be one of them, by the way. that this is a fundamental human right, and that these sort of fine distinctions don't avail. I'm dubious about that.
Let me get on the other side of this. I'm going to play devil's advocate a little
sure.
bit. You know, I was online earlier today, and it didn't take much Googling or putting into a search engine to find a list of donors with their name. And it was on a website specifically to target people who donated to Yes on Prop 8, telling me I should not patronize this one storage company in San Diego because this man gave $693,000 to the cause. I had home addresses, emails, websites. You know, are activists just using the tools that they have available to them in 2008 in just an effective way?
Well, it depends on what you think the limits of civility are. If I'm not entirely sure what our guarantees of free speech and equal participation in the political process. And in our process, in our system, money and speech politically are interchangeable. It's not clear to me what those guarantees are worth. If in fact, people are then going to be targeted in their homes or at their place of employment for having expressed themselves. Now, you know, this is a two-edged sword. And do we really want to get into a situation where the Yes on 8 people target everyone who gave to the opposition campaign? Mm-hmm. I mean, I think it's a sobering prospect, and it further lowers not just the level of civility in our system, but it's in some ways a threat to the process itself.
We're asking for you to call into us if you're especially from California. How have you seen the issue of the response to Prop 8 play out? Do you agree there needs to be some cooling down or not? Our number here in Washington is 1-800-989-8255. We're going to go to Joe in California. Hi, Joe.
Yes.
Hi, Joe. So what are your thoughts on this issue?
Well, I voted for Proposition 8. However, I do feel that the people who are against it are well within their rights to demonstrate, even in front of churches or whatever they want to do. However, I do, like your guest, I feel that there's a danger if we get into the area of taking out personal vendettas against people who vote against the way you want to vote. And I think that is crossing the line. There does need to be a cooling down.
Joe from Chico, California, thank you so much for calling. This is Talk of the Nation from NPR News. We're speaking with Tim Rutten, an LA Times columnist who wrote a column this past weekend, both sides in the same-sex marriage controversy need to cool down. So, Tim, I have to imagine you've had some reaction to your column.
Oh, you might say. I think that by Saturday I had somewhere north of 300 emails, which is, that's a fairly substantial immediate response. Most of the emails, by the way, disagreed with the column from one poll or the other.
Mm-hmm.
And by the way, like your caller just a minute ago, the gentleman in Chico, the column did make the point that there was no argument against protests, including in front of Mormon temples and Catholic cathedrals, which have occurred, and that's certainly well within the realm of things people are entitled to do and perhaps should do. But it did make the argument that and I never used the phrase cool down. I don't think that people that's the headline writer, and I don't write the headlines.
Ah.
But the
well, got somebody.
I never used that phrase because I don't think if I were a gay or lesbian person in California today, I wouldn't cool down. I'd be angry.
Tom in Colorado agrees with you. Hi, Tom.
Hey, this is Tom. I'm in Colorado. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I 100% agree. I would not cool down. I would continue the pressure. As far as the lady who runs the store got her lost her job, good. She's taken our money for years. These people have come into our homes and attacked us, and I wouldn't cool down for a second.
All right, Tom in Boulder, Colorado, thank you so much. We have an email here from Sherry from California who writes, I'm a married lesbian in Northern California. I agree that the No on 8 movement needs a more positive strategy. I suggest we all go to the next Knights of Columbus pancake breakfast and get to know each other. In other words, let's build bridges instead of burning them. Have you seen people like Sherry? Have people like Sherry written into you, Tom? Tim? Excuse me?
A very small number. Many of them, obviously, members of the gay and lesbian communities. But yes, there are people who say that, and principally because the argument resonates with them that it's exactly protected speech and protected political expression that have made possible some of the very necessary strides in equal rights and equal protection for gay and lesbian people that we've seen in the last over these last few years. It's been one of the great and welcome developments in American society, and as I say, I think, to my mind, something that's absolutely necessary. But I think people ought not to deceive themselves that this was achieved except under these very protections.
Tim Rutten is a columnist for the LA Times. He joined us from the Marketplace Studios in Los Angeles. Tim, thanks a lot.
Glad to be with you.
We do have a quick programming note. We need your help with our Thanksgiving Day show. If you remember the WPA state guides of the 30s, they were legendary. The mantra? To describe America to Americans. Across the country, writers describe their states, the beauty of them, the warts of it all. Now we want you to contribute to that tradition. Send us your description of your home state. Email us a short essay, about 100 words. Tell us what makes your state special. Its humor, accents, peculiarities, if I could say that. Maybe just that corner bar where everyone remembers your name. Email your essay to talk@npr.org and put state in the subject line. You might get a chance to read it on the air on Thanksgiving Day. This is Talk of the Nation from NPR News.